Hey everyone, I have a question. Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, awesome, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have a ton of cool features like curated podcast lists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but our new members-only version of The Professor Is In podcast is only available on the Himalaya app. So be sure and download it, check it out, and keep an eye out for our members-only content.
Hi, and welcome to The Professor Is In podcast. I'm Karen Kelski.
And I'm Kel Weinhold.
And we are happy to be here today
for our inaugural episode of The Professor Is In podcast, in which we are going to talk about
how the Academy is a cult.
That's episode number one. We might as well come in with a hot take.
So if you don't know, The Professor Is In, it's been around since about 2011 in various different platforms like the blog and the book, webinars, live talks, all kinds of things. And the main agenda that we had when we started The Professor Is In is to demystify the Academy and all of the unspoken rules that you are expected to know without anyone ever teaching you. Mm-hmm. And the ways that it's just filled with all of these judgments that are incredibly rigid and unyielding and, you know, really foster kind of a culture of shame as well as insularity.
Yeah. And in that process, you know, where you could have a system that you could come into that pedagogically was focused on trying to give you the information that you came there to get, or you can have a system that obfuscates the information. And then when you bump up against the edges of it and don't understand it, they shame you back into a corner. Mm-hmm. So that's really what we want to talk about today is how, and Karen talks about this in her book, The Professor Is In, about how the Academy is a cult and why it so completely matches with a cult identity.
Well, I mean, the thing is, and I just got back from the American Academy of Religion annual conference, and I just want to be real clear for any religious studies folks out there that this may not be the formal definition of a cult that scholars use. But I think if you really think through it a little bit, there are a lot of ways that it is certainly similar. And those ways are, first of all, that it has a very strong set of cultural norms. It has a language that is shared. It has a long indoctrination period, which is, of course, your PhD training program that, you know, takes, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 to 10, 12 years if you're in history. It has really intense value judgments about insider, outsider. And if you make a false step, or what, you know, the cult believes is a false step, you know, you're kind of shunned. You're kind of set outside of the community. And also, because it's kind of an enclave setting, all of your friends are members of the cult as well. And so when you think about it, the PhD training program process is kind of adjacent to, I don't want to oversell the cult parallel, but it is an indoctrination process. And I think that we really, when we kind of try to demystify the Academy and work with people to have a healthier relationship to it, we really want to start there and say, what kind of unspoken messages did you receive and accept that you're now imposing on yourself as well as having others impose them on you?
So there was an interesting article in the Atlantic in 2014 about the 7 signs that you're in a cult. And I remember when I saw it that you and I had been talking at some point, maybe on Facebook Live, about how the Academy is a cult. And so often, you know, you and I are riffing in different directions and we see the connections and then our conversation is over and we don't write it down. But I remember finding this article soon after that because I thought we should go really identify what is a cult. And so This article is really interesting because it's 7 signs that you're in a cult. But one of the first things is opposing critical thinking.
Hmm.
And I think that it would be so easy to look at the Academy and say, well, certainly that doesn't qualify because the Academy is all about critical thinking. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We take up ideas and we think of them critically. Mm-hmm. Except that if we think about the Academy's resistance to any kind of critique or critical analysis of how it does what it does, mm-hmm. how courses are set up, critiquing the canon of any field, that there is an intense, it's hidebound. It's like, we're going to stick to this. And those of you who question it, and I think any of you listening who sit outside the sort of standard academic identity, which is cisgendered white male with property who has someone do all of his work, well, that means most people. Anyway, so if you sit outside that, you probably can identify times in your time in the academy when you have tried to critique or been critically thinking about the way it was done and the response that you got to that. It typically isn't, well, let us throw up our open arms and welcome you in.
Right.
It's, we're going to talk about why you are not, mm-hmm. we're going to shame you. And shaming is used as a system to push people out of a group.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do with shame.
Exactly. So, while we're on the subject, what are the other six?
Well, the second one is
elements of a cult:
isolating members and penalizing them for leaving.
Oh my gosh! Okay,
all right.
Emphasizing
special doctrines outside of Scripture, and this happens to be talking about Christian cults, mm-hmm. but sort of special, like the special Scripture or the special doctrines of your field,
right?
Seeking inappropriate loyalty to their leaders.
Gosh. Okay.
Here's an idea. We're going to hire you for this job, and then we want you to wear the branded material, and then we want you to donate to our annual fund.
What about the relationship of people with their PIs and their advisors?
Oh, and they're right.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Right.
Long before. I mean, I'm interested, when I think about the academy as a cult, I'm far more interested in the indoctrination period, which is grad school. Rather than
that leads to the
that leads
stuff
to
later.
Then right. how it's replicated generationally once people actually get jobs. And just a reminder, and we're absolutely going to address this over and over again in the podcast moving forward, is the majority of people don't get jobs.
Right.
Only a tiny minority of people, between 5% and 30% of PhDs, get tenure track jobs. So that's the exception. That's the alternative career route. The normative career route is you don't stay in the academy. But in any case, that's a subject for another day. But yeah, the indoctrination still happens.
Mm-hmm. There's dishonoring the family unit, which I think is interesting to think about the way that the academy sort of wraps its arms around you and tells you how you're different, mm-hmm. and how the way they do things are different. And there's that sort of great unwashed out there who really mm-hmm. don't get it.
Absolutely.
Which for most of us then by de facto separates us from our family units.
Mm-hmm.
That if we're constantly being told we're different than our four siblings who didn't get a PhD, mm-hmm. or our parents who never went to college, or our community where you're the unicorn, you're constantly being separated.
So do you mean to say, when they say dishonoring the family unit, you mean the cult separates you from your family unit? Is that the point?
Right. It's like the family unit is not the mm-hmm. is the not the area of authority or of bonds or connections.
Right.
That thing is sort of your dead past.
Right.
And now you have to come to your new enlightened.
And that
present.
Is certainly true. For the majority, I think the majority of PhDs, there are PhDs who have almost a seamless connection with their parents and other relatives who are also academics, but that's, I think, probably an exception.
Mm-hmm. The other one is crossing biblical boundaries of behavior, which I think talks about, like, there are all these rules within Scripture of how you're supposed to behave, and then you get into a cult and there's the rules break down. So relationships, mm-hmm. sexual relationships with leaders,
and that sort of thing. Yeah, that makes
which
sense.
Then I started thinking about that one in relationship to all of the boundary breakers, men and some women who are in relationships that are culturally and socially inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You're the power person. You're in a relationship with your graduate student. You're in a relationship with an undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
So that same sort of, we're going to go in here. Now we're going to break all the rules about.
Right. Inappropriate intimacy, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Basically.
I have an issue with this article that sounds like it's making a distinction that's sort of, it seems to be implying that biblical things are fine and good and all of that. And then it's like, oh, if you're deviating from those, that's the cult. So, you know, with my evangelical commitments, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I hear what you're, I see where we're going here.
Right. I'm not interested in debating the questions around this as it relates to Christian theology and the Bible and everything else, because hear me now, not interested, don't care. So I'm only looking at this as examples.
Right.
I don't want to dive into whether the Bible is
exactly.
right or
wrong. We're not going to go into a critique of this article.
Right.
Just going to jump off from it to think about the academy.
Right. And then the last one that I think is really interesting is separation from the church. So if you have a core church and then these cults pull you away from it. So for me, then that made me think, where does it happen within the academy that people are pulled off to the side from their discipline or pulled off to the side from the larger stated project of the academy, which mm-hmm. is this sort of intellectual tenacity and openness to dialogue and mm-hmm. all of the stuff. And then it's just this constant cleaving people away from that.
Right.
I mean, how many times have you been in a graduate class and there could be this really amazing conversation and there's like some hammer that comes down and says, but we're discussing Foucault.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, I just think about how often in my own life and having heard it from so many others that we got into the academy because we loved ideas and reading and books and libraries and archives and all this curiosity. And we think that that's what we're getting into. And we do a master's and we're in the first year and it's still pretty good. And the second year, it's less good. And then you're in the PhD program and suddenly it's, you know, curiosity is the last thing that's being fostered there. It's really, you know, it's indoctrination into a set of right thinking.
They call it a discipline for a
reason,
right?
Yeah, they call it a discipline for a reason.
Right.
Just to be clear, I don't have a problem with the idea of disciplines, but because they do give you the central questions of your field and orient your thinking around questions and thematics that are not immediately obvious. And that's what makes scholarship, is that it's going deeper. It's going beyond what is just the realm of the obvious. And I love that. At the Professor's Inn, we love the idea of scholarship. We love the practice of scholarship. Want to support it in every way. I'd love to see the Academy be abundantly funded and a vibrant institution in the U.S. and everywhere else. But so what we're talking about here is really just the ways that this gets twisted mm-hmm. in people's minds, really around shame, I think, really around the idea that there's right and wrong, insider, outsider, and that as you get indoctrinated into it, you begin to apply that shame to yourself mm-hmm. and you begin to shame yourself for primarily... Well, a couple of things. First of all, imposter syndrome. I don't know enough. I'm not good enough. I'm a fraud. I don't belong. And then the other kind of shame is I'm not writing enough. I'm not doing enough. The guy in the office next to me has written 4 books. I haven't written any books. I can't even get my first book written. Or they have 3 chapters of their dissertation done. I don't have any chapters of my dissertation done. They write 10 pages a day. I write 0 pages a day. And that shame as well. And of course, they're not mutually exclusive.
Right. Well, I think that this, if we think about how these systems of containment or oppression or repression or whatever you want to call them, how they come about, I think you can look at Brené Brown's research on vulnerability and what we do to avoid being vulnerable. And, mm-hmm. and 2 of the main things that she says have to exist in a system for which the outcome is kind of a withdrawal or a shutdown. And that's what I feel like happens so much when we talk to clients. It's people who have been sort of pushed down and shut down and pushed away and outsidered, and they start to lose confidence in themselves. They lose confidence in their scholarship, their ideas. Imposter syndrome takes over. And, you know, you and I have talked about it before, and we want to make it really clear to everyone that, and you're going to hear this from us a lot, is that we consider these responses, this shame, this imposter syndrome, not belonging, part of a systemic issue where you might be inclined to take it on as an individual issue, and that the system is set up, like so much of the neoliberal world right now, to individualize the response, to say, it's because of you that this is happening. So getting back to Brown's work, if we look at her work on vulnerability, what she finds is that systems that depend on shame and comparison as their main forces result in detachment, meaning they result in people sort of emotionally and everything else disappearing. And for some people that they can function in that and they produce a lot of work, but for most people, they lose their ability to kind of get things done mm-hmm. in the way that everybody keeps saying they should.
So or even the folks who do get stuff done do so at great cost
right.
in terms of their relationships,
mm-hmm.
their physical health, their mental health. So
absolutely.
So, you know, the Professor's Inn is really has been about trying to get across the systemic structures that make individual PhDs, grads, and everyone, you know, circling around the PhD, grad students and so on, postdocs, junior faculty, senior faculty, really begin to realize that the struggles they're having are not individual failures.
Right.
That's really it. And that there are forces that are Especially, well, like you said, to the extent that you are not a cisgender, upper-class white male, there are real forces that are actively or directly and indirectly telling you you don't belong and your voice is not legitimate, especially if you're one who is bringing that critical thinking to the epistemological foundations of your field itself.
Right. And the cult-like response is going to amp up the more that you push against any of those categories that we talked about. Mm-hmm. So the more you speak out critically about it, the more you operate in a way that is not the defined operating, the more you say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not okay. Mm-hmm. I think is when we see that shame and comparison come in. So stop for just a second, for those of you who are listening, and run your eyes over the past and look at the times that you have been in a space in the academy and you reached, pushed out with an idea, pushed out with a comment, and you had that shame you back into place response where somebody said you hadn't read enough yet, that you didn't know what you were talking about. Or one of my favorites, the classic, oh, you haven't read that? Which to me is like, oh, boy, does that one push my buttons. Mm-hmm. Probably because there's so much I haven't read.
Or the time my advisor came back from a conference and said, Karen, people are talking about you at the conference, and it wasn't good.
I guess it depends on what you define as good, advisor.
Yeah.
Right? But there's a whole bunch of shaming that goes on. So what we're asking you to do in this sort of out-of-the-gate episode is to begin to deconstruct those places where you have accepted personal or individual responsibility for a system that is designed to beat you into shape.
Right. Make you an insider or cast you out as an outsider, whether it's in terms of what you know, what you've read, the theory that you adhere to, the proper obeisance to your, you know, the intellectual leaders and Foucault or whoever else is in your field, or the level of productivity, how much you produce, how fast you produce it. All of those things are places where comparison and shame come into play and are disciplinary techniques.
Right.
So on the one hand, we like disciplines because they're great. They help us organize our thoughts to do the intellectual work we want to do. And at the same time, we're taking issue with the process of disciplining that is cult-like, that's insider-outsider, shaming, shame-based, comparison-based.
So one of the first places that you can make an intervention for yourself is to start to notice where you have bought the party line.
Yeah.
Where you have started to say, oh, this is my fault. Mm-hmm. And say, wait a minute, is it my fault? Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, am I being punished for thinking outside the box? Wait a minute, do I not feel like I belong here because there's this whole set of rules that either I don't understand and they're trying to, you know, discipline me into, or I don't agree with. And so one of the things I think we want to do is talk about both of those. That what do you do when you don't agree with them? And what do you do when you don't understand them? Mm-hmm. Right? Once you can do that, then you can start to separate yourself from the cult.
Exactly. All right.
What more is there to say?
So one of Kel's trademark phrases, and she has several of them, and you'll be hearing about them as we move forward in our podcast. And this is one that she uses that's really foundational to her whole Unstuck Productivity Program, which, by the way, is, we call it a productivity program, but that's not exactly what it is. And Kel can say more about that because it's really about it's a good boundaries program. Right. It's about a proper psychological, mental health, physical health while you pursue academic pursuits program, organizing your life in a life-giving, life-affirming way program while you stay in the academy. But the point I wanted to make is that one of her foundational quotes from that is, comparison is the thief of joy. Comparison is the thief of joy. And if you're wondering what Buddhist said that, well, that Buddhist is Teddy Roosevelt.
No, it was so disappointing to you when you found out it wasn't Pema Chodron or something. Like, what do you mean it's Teddy Roosevelt? But it is the reason I love that maxim so much is, and I know that a ton of people who've worked with me have that posted on a post-it note on their computers just to remind themselves over and over again, because it goes both ways. that, first of all, if you are sitting in your room, and I remember this with one of the early clients I worked with, and she was saying, I know, you know, I'm sitting here this summer and everybody's in their offices and I know they're just all writing 8 hours a day and I'm just sitting here freaking out. And I started laughing and I said, I'm going to guarantee you that's not happening. First of all, and second of all, you have no idea. So you're making yourself miserable in a comparison that you have no fact. Mm-hmm. So there's that, comparing yourself to other people and how miserable you're making. Of course, a year and a half later, when she finished her book and said all those people she thought were being productive hadn't written nearly as much, she had to rethink that. And then that flips to the other side of it, is that if you were on the other side and you have written that book, or you're the person with five articles and you are looking at somebody else saying, you haven't produced as much as I have, you are not as good as I am, that also sucks your joy. Mm-hmm. It makes you an asshole. And it takes away you celebrating your own thing. So it's not just somebody looking at somebody you perceive as doing more than you've done, but it's also that same toxic part of the academy that looks in at somebody who hasn't done as much and compares.
Well, whenever you judge in life, whenever you judge anyone, you're judging yourself.
Right.
I mean, this is just one of those hard-won human truths that is hard to confront. And you can confront, and it's easier in some places and harder in others for all of us, I think. But if you are sitting there saying, oh, I can't believe you wore that, or I can't believe you did that, or I can't believe you said that, or I can't believe you haven't read that, when you're busy projecting those judgments on other people, you're applying them to yourself.
Right.
You may not realize it in the moment. You may be in denial about that, but you are. And it means that you're operating within those judgments and you don't emerge from that unscathed. So this is heavy work. It's really deep work. It's life work, which is why the Unstuck program is as powerful as it is, because it starts out ostensibly being about how, you know, the writing that you are stalled on, or the project or whatever it is, your manuscript, your dissertation, but it ends up being about kindness to yourself and telling the truth to yourself about the real circumstances of your life. So anyway, we'll be weaving in and out of that as well as we proceed forward in the podcast.
Yeah, we'll be weaving in and out of the productivity things that I work on. We'll be weaving in and out of the practical advice that Karen has to give you about the job market and getting tenure and publication and all of those different things. So you're going to see one of the notes we have written down is sort of our guiding lights of that Karen is going to introduce a whole bunch of scary gremlins, and I'm going to be the one who tames your response to those gremlins.
Right.
In other words, you know, it's scary. It's scary to publish. It's scary to apply for jobs. It's scary to think about what the economy and the economics of this all look like. And we're here to kind of hold up the mirror and say, look, the only way to deal with it is look at it.
Mm-hmm. Tell the truth about it.
It's not going to be fun, but at least we're not going to be living in a dream world.
Mm-hmm.
And then to talk about ways to keep yourself healthy and stable and enjoying your life in the academy as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Our promise to you, our listeners, just as it has been to our readers all these years, is that we will tell you the truth to the best of our ability. We're not oracles. We don't know everything. We don't pretend to by any stretch of the imagination. We are always interested in feedback and places where you think we have missed something. We welcome those comments all the time. And to the extent that we're able, we will tell you the truth. We'll tell you the truth about the Academy as we see it. And of course, our really strong commitment to talk about racism, white privilege, white supremacy in the academy and the way that it operates, as well as other classism, homophobia, sexism, of course, and the patriarchy. Yeah. And then while doing so, really with the intent to empower you.
Mm-hmm.
That's our goal. Our goal is not to beat you up. Our goal is to empower you to understand the real circumstances and conditions of the field that you're in, not the field per se, like your disciplinary field, but you know, this area of enterprise of the academy as an institution, and make the best choices you can.
Yeah, and I would add, is the sort of pulling off the Band-Aid really fast, that the academy is an industry. We talk about it as an institution and a lot of different things, but the reality is that it is like any other market-driven force, mm-hmm. market-driven entity. And a lot of what we see, and I think Karen really works with in the work that she does, is trying to get people to look at and understand their place in the economic system that is the academy and how you best position yourself for. And I think that's really hard and a big loss for a lot of people to give up the idea that they're part of something that's sort of separate from mm-hmm. it all. That yeah. this is devoid of these things. And, right. and they keep doing things based on what it should be right. instead of what it is.
That's how you end up exploited.
Yeah, absolutely.
You allow yourself to be exploited because you think that it's a labor of love that cannot be monetized or instrumentalized. And actually, the academy is a labor market. And what you do, the academic work, whether even if it's reading and writing articles and going to conferences or teaching in the classroom, it's labor. You're compensated for it to some degree or another, to a greater or lesser degree, usually lesser. And there are conditions of exploitation that prevail in the academy, in this industry, especially as it really collapses in on itself in the economic crisis that has been going on for the last 30 years. So that's our real goal, is to allow you to understand your own work in relation to that labor market as well.
So if you made it through this first episode and are not curled up under your desk crying right now, we hope you will join us next week when we're going to talk about how to operate within the cult alongside the cult members and keep your selfhood intact. So join us next week.
Bye-bye.